station. We will continue to broadcast special programming like the one that you're hearing right now. I mean, today marks the 76th anniversary commemoration of the Nakba. And when something like that happens here on WBAI, we really do take seriously on how privileged we are to have a Pacifica radio station in our listening area, and it needs to be maintained. It needs to be maintenance for us to do what we have been doing for so long. So I appeal to the listeners out there before we go into yet another hour of programming, and we're going to be at this most of the day. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to show your support. 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online. Support what you can so we can keep this going. And now, with all that said, we're going to go back into the programming, focusing on Nakba here on WBAI New York, and it's part of the very special programming that is being produced by most Pacifica stations, primarily from WPFW 89.3 FM. I forgot the signal. Oh man, I screwed that up. All right, let's go back into the programming right now.
Marathon airing on Nakba Day, May 15th, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across five continents.
We'll be right back. فقدت لي فنت واشتا فصرت رهينا تحت أهوائي أبكي على هشاشاني من فرقتي وطني طوعا ويسعدوني من نوح أعدائي أدنو فيبعدوني خوفي فيقلقوني شوق تمكن فيه مكنون يحشاني فكيف أصنع فيه حب كلفته به مولاي قد ملا من سقم أطبائي قالوا تداوى به فقلت له
Palestine, once I took it over, was my feeling of what is happening to me as a human being, not only as Giuliano, in this chaotic place of contradictions, of occupation, with inside security special forces of the Palestinians and the Israeli special forces coming here, and in between we have the Palestinian Authority sitting, poverty, solidarity, and a lot of collaborators, the death, the funerals, the shaheeds, how life from these graveyards, so many graveyards, so many dead people, and life still pumping out. All this came to my head in this hot, unbearable summer. And I felt that I want to blow up. And I said, let's blow up with the students. I'm going to give them the energy that is going into my head in this psychotic, hectic. And I felt at the end that this gonna go to an explosion. So I thought this explosion gonna be the death will rebel. I had a vision of graveyards in Jenin, like the graves are like a horror movie, and the death are going out and they're rebelling. That was my vision of the show. I hope it's not much in the face. I hope not. If it's punch in the face, it's not good. It's a, I would say, a mirror in the face. It's a bleeding mirror in the face. expressing myself.
Guatemala, Nicaragua, Mozambique. من حقق مع عمك وابوك وابن خالك من مرقش ميزانية من مرق سلاح الصينية من فرق من عنصر الحرب هاي نفسية تفكرها أهلية تفكرها دينية بتفرق بتعنصر بنفسك بتفكر ديمقراطية بتفرق بتعنصر بنفسك بتفكر ديمقراطية
أيوة يلا كله عيني على الكاميرات ما في بشي يبنى شكلين لمين أصلا كل الاستعراض عايش الفخامة على دين كوكا كوكا كلنا من عد عبارات
ما فيش مصاري
أحلى صحرا أحلى الناس عطشة عطشة الناس عطشة المي سحلة بتروي الأرض الخضرة
بيطلع منها سيلفي بنتها
أيوة يلا كله عيني على الكاميرات ما في بيجي يبنى شكلين لمين أصلا كل الاستعراض عايش الفخامة على دين كوكا كوكا كلنا من عند عبارات ولا حدا فينا بيكتب كلمتين ويدي لما الدنيا ماشي ترلالا دقيقة لما الدنيا دقيقة يا ربي ليه
مستقلة داخلية خايفة من النكمة اللي بتبس أنا فهم المسؤولية عارفة إنه المطارات مش رح تكون لي ودودية بس وقعنا طيارات لازم نوصل العالمية دولة ناسا من أساسها ما تقوليش أفكار وهمية مش رح نوصل MTVs كمان أنغامي عالمية بنقدر نعمل ستوري إذا كانت إيدنا فولاذية
ما يهمك ما يهمك ما فيش مصاري
قومي طلعي ليهمك قدر الله والكاتب ربك يسير عن العريس الف اسم الله أميره يا ابن الأمير
You are in the mix with DJ Abby. This program is part of Radio Free Palestine, an annual 24-hour marathon airing on Nakba Day, May 15th, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across five continents.
Logre unirse a otras en México. Primero se convierte en murmullo, luego en voz alta, y después en un grito que escuchen en casa. No sabemos nosotros, no sabemos ustedes, pero nosotros y nosotras, zapatistas del EZLN, sabemos lo importante que es, en medio de la destrucción y la muerte, escuchar unas palabras de aliento. No sé cómo explicarlo, pero resulta que sí. Y las palabras desde lejos tal vez no alcanzan a detener una bomba, pero son como si se abriera una grieta en la negra habitación de la muerte y una lucecita se colara. Por lo demás, pasará lo que después iba a pasar.
Thank you. البلد. أبو تركة ممنوع، الشرطة يا مجروح. عارفة أمي ولا
مين يكنس البلد؟
هو مليارات الدولارات عشان نعيش في شتاء
مليارات الدولارات عشان نعيش في شتاء
مين يرابي قلبتنا يا دوب رشين
خلوها باللت في دمشق بعين الحلوين
هو مليارات الدولارات عشان نعيش في شتاء
مليارات الدولارات عشان نعيش في شتاء
مسالم مثل الصوفي والبوذي لا تواخذون انا مش مزوخي قصفوا مي بظرف شهر يوغا ما عاد يكفيني صمودي
تخيل الي جيوشي نفوذي تخيل صورتي على نقودي عباية كلها خيوطي مش عباية كوتشي كوتشي
طردنا نوال من البلد عرضنا وندف ومن بالبلد شايف النفاق يا ولد شو نفلس هالبلد
ما تقدس هالبلد البلد افتح شبابيك وعزل البلد نظف البلد زين البلد spring is coming فميل على البلد
I've got a stone could build us a home to weather us through the hard thunder and storms I've got a stone could build you a throne so you'd be right where you always belonged I took the key and kept it with me so we would come back when we are free I wrote a song so you'd sing along for our children to know where we're from I wrote a song sing along I've got a stone and it was thrown so that they finally leave us alone collected our own and buried their bones it's terrifying our futures unknown They took our soil, our olives and oil, forever condemned to a lifetime of toil. They took it all, and they built a wall, to make us feel helpless and feeble and small. But it will fall. It will fall.
The Palestinian people who are uprooted, thrown in the camps, living in starvation, forbidden to use even the name Palestinians. To us, to liberate our country, to have dignity, to have respect, to have our mere human rights is something as essential as life itself.
I'm gonna brave the storm although I'm sweaty. I'm gonna hold my head up though it's heavy. I'm gonna walk on though my feet are bloody. I've seen it all, whatever comes, I'm ready. I'm gonna brave the storm, although I'm sweaty. I'm gonna hold my head up, though it's heavy. I'm gonna walk, although my feet are bloody. 'Cause I've seen it all. They took our stones and made them their own But with time the truth will be told I took a stone, a piece of our home They didn't notice that it was gone I've got a stone, got a stone I've got a stone
You are listening to a 24-hour special on Nakba Day, produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine, with the English stream produced by WPFW. Thank you so much for tuning in. Radio Free Palestine continues after this break, so stay tuned.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York, and here's some Samori Marksman
supporter of human rights and the international peace movement, a much-loved program director here at WBAI, reflecting on the 60s.
I'm torn by the tragedy of seeing great people pass. Kind of make me sort of wonder. I mean, it kind of make us feel that it's our turn next, you know, because a lot of people who left town are people whom we knew. I look at many people like Stokely Carmichael, of course, Kwame Ture, and having known him and so on, it's touched me, and I just, looking at something early and saw his name again, and it just kind of reminded me about that there isn't much left for those of us who were around in the 60s, you know, with people like that. People like John Henry Clark, another personal friend who, you know, took so much with him, and many of the other figures who we looked at, many entertainers and, you know, other people who made great contributions. And, you know, I'm ending with this sense of great loss, but I'm also ending in a tone of not only pondering and reflecting on these things, but being genuinely concerned.
Speaking of genuine concern, this is WBAI New York, and we're asking you to help WBAI, help keep it on the air. Support WBAI's Tower Fund. Go to towerfund.wbai.org. Keep it going. Call 212-209-2950. Support WBAI. Contribute what you can to keep this experiment, long-running experiment in free speech, in alternate views, in progressive commentary and programming you won't hear anywhere on the mainstream. Let's keep it alive. Let's keep it going.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
Give us a call, 212-209-2950. Support WBAI. In honor of Samori and all of the broadcasters and guests who have appeared on WBAI through the ages, preserving a platform for future speakers, for future voices to come on the air right here in the center of the FM dial at 99.5 FM, to come on to WBAI, to come on to this platform and share their views and engage with you. Please help support WBAI, 212-209-2950, in honor of Samori and all the other voices you've heard here on WBAI, and all the voices that you will hear, but you don't even know who you're going to hear, but you'll hear them if you tune in to 99.5 FM in the center of the FM dial, or if you listen online, as so many of our listeners do, at WBAI.org. Please come forward and support WBAI. Become a listener member of WBAI for $25 for the year, or become a BAI buddy, a sustaining member, for 15 or more a month. And this helps WBAI know how much money is coming in, because WBAI doesn't get any corporate sponsorship. Our sponsorship is from you, our listeners, who support WBAI, who appreciate WBAI, who want to uplift WBAI and the voices that you can hear on this listener-sponsored station. Again, 212-209-2950. Please come forward right now. Let's do it for Samori. Let's do it for the other Samoris who are yet to be heard on WBAI. We thank you for your support. Please come forward now and give us a call, 212-209-2950. Thank you. Thank you so much.
No justice, no peace. 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 No justice, no peace.
Peace.
Babylon system is a condemnation. Exists all over the world. No love for humanity. Our nation, they cannot see. They're brainwashed by the system. Ooh, but who'd you bless?
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine.
While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. Free, free Palestine. Free, free Palestine. Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution, sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle. Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. They're trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby. Just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide, but whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
Sex worker.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine.
While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts. What I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets. Please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war. We shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's enough.
Palestinian Feminist Collective. That's enough. And I'm a writer and a teacher.
Hannah, do you want to go?
Sure. Hi, I'm Hannah Musby. I am also a writer and a teacher, and I am a member of the Palestinian Youth Movement. I organize with the Palestinian Youth Movement. I also am proud to organize with the newly created Palestinian Feminist Collective.
Yes, I go ahead.
Yeah, sure. And then Hannah are so humble. My name is Yazan, and I am a community organizer, and I also work as a researcher. So I organize with the Palestinian Youth Movement in Southern California, and I work as the community organizer for an organization called Vigilant Love, which does a lot of work looking at the structural and communal impacts of Islamophobia and the war on terror, especially with regards to surveillance. And yeah, I spend most of my other work doing research on the relationship between war, migration, and surveillance. Also very excited to be part of the PFC and here today.
Thank you all. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the purpose of today's live. I think the main idea was to kind of just put some faces behind this name, the Palestinian Feminist Collective. We wanted to talk a little bit about who we are. Today, our collective has about 80 members. And so we will talk about how we came together. We also want to talk about our first public initiative, which is the pledge that many of our Facebook community may have read already and signed. And finally, I wanted to address, or I wanted us to address, a few of the comments and questions that we received from our community around the pledge. And if time permits and we see some questions from our Facebook community here, then maybe we'll try our best to answer some of those as well. So to start with, what is the Palestinian Feminist Collective? I don't know if you want to take this one, Yazan.
Sure. So the Palestinian Feminist Collective is a collective of academics, organizers, and other professionals who identify as Arab or Palestinian feminists. We originally started from an initiative that came from the 2020 International Women's Day Statement released by the Palestinian Youth Movement. But since then, we went through the process of becoming a working group that was developing ideas for looking at how we as Palestinian feminists in the U.S. could tackle anti-repression work against liberal Zionism and also work on developing collective healing for a community within the Palestinian and Arab communities in the U.S. and abroad. So from the working group process, we started developing more concrete ideas and proposals for work that we have since been able to launch. And at that time is when we started transitioning into the Palestinian Feminist Collective that's more formally seen today. I don't know if Hannah, you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think that that essentially covers our history. I think the only thing I would add is also just kind of our focus on trying to hold together social and political liberation. And that's something that I'm sure we will get more into in this discussion.
So let's hone in maybe on our pledge, our first public initiative, the pledge that Palestine is a feminist issue. This is a public pledge and a commitment that we put out on March 15th, where we worked with ally organizations to sign and help publicize and share all over this this pledge. The aim of this pledge and commitment that Palestine is a feminist issue was aimed at broadly ally organizations and just people, just as loving people and individuals, as well as organizations, but also U.S. women and feminist organizations that have long ignored or kind of collaborated really in mainstreaming of Zionist thought in the U.S. I wanted Neda to talk to us a little bit more about where this idea came from and why is it important.
Unmute. Okay, so sure, Mira, as you pointed out, feminism has long been excluded from most progressive, from a lot of progressive spaces that have mainstreamed Zionism. Most activists, most allies in the struggle for Palestinian, for justice in Palestine and for the Palestinian people are familiar with the expression PEP, progressive except for Palestine. And one manifestation of PEP is FEP, feminist except for Palestine. And we've encountered this feminism except for Palestine in our organizing for decades. I mean, as far back as I remember as a young feminist organizer, I would constantly encounter this. And so the pledge is in some ways a reaction, a response to the feminism except for Palestine. I think every Palestinian woman, every Arab or Muslim woman in the US has experienced some manifestation of FEP, feminism except for Palestine, where all the wonderful analysis of feminism as a liberating ideology suddenly collapses when our circumstances are discussed because we are primarily oppressed by Zionism. So the basic concept in feminism that the personal is political and the political is personal suddenly disappears when it comes to analyzing Palestinian women's circumstances because we are not even allowed to name our oppressor as Zionism. So, and it's gone on for decades and it's gone on multiple levels from the Women's March to publishing, publishing personal essays, publishing articles, publishing scholarship, to teaching, to mainstream, even anti-racist alliance and coalition work. And it's happened in so many different spaces. One tends to think primarily of the space of mainstream white feminism, but it's also happened in spaces where we thought we had allies. And so I'm going to share a couple of experiences. And I have my, here, I put this book alongside me to remind me to share this experience. So this is the book, This Bridge We Call Home. And for me, this is a very good manifestation of the kind of feminism except for Palestine that Palestinian feminists and our allies have encountered over the years. So this book was published in 2002. It was envisioned as the 20-year anniversary of that absolutely groundbreaking anthology, This Bridge Called Our Back, which is, as I said, the absolutely groundbreaking anthology by radical feminists of color in the U.S. And 20 years later, there was this desire by some publishers and editors to come up with a 20-year anniversary edition, and that's This Bridge We Call Home. And in This Bridge We Call Home was the first time that Arab American feminists were in conversation with other feminists of color and not of color in the US in a major publication. And so the editors had started an email conversation among all of the contributors to this anthology. And in the email conversation prior to the publication of the book, there was so much attack and hatred towards the Arab American feminist contributors. There are eight of us Arab American feminist contributors, and the kind of absolutely toxic environment that happened because we were speaking out against Zionism, because we were critical of Israel, is an idea, gives you one idea of the many, many, many spaces where Arab American feminism, Palestinian feminism was shut down with hatred in supposedly feminist spaces, right? And so the pledge addresses that kind of experience that we've had where we are shut out of feminist places. This unfortunately happened in a place that was supposedly progressive and radical, but it happens throughout. And that's one example. And, you know, let me know if I have time to discuss more examples. But I
Yeah, please go ahead. I was actually also, in addition to more examples, I was just curious maybe to let people know, since you have, you know, all of these experiences working as an activist, as a scholar, have things changed really throughout all of these years that you've been active? Have you seen showing solidarity even in, I don't know, organizations in the U.S., but if you can tell us a little bit about if you've seen a shift and have things improved.
And we are coming back to you now. We are replaying a program that we played early this morning, but in fact, we have worked out the technical difficulties with Nkechi Taifa, Human Rights Attorneys program. So we are going to go to that program now, Human Rights and Justice for Radio Free Palestine.
We've always had allies. I don't want to say that this is a recent development.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Alafia and welcome. This is Nkechi Taifa, civil and human rights attorney, scholar activist, freedom fighter, and bestseller author. This is Human Rights and Justice, my thought-provoking talk show featuring kick-ass commentary and stimulating guests. We discuss domestic and global themes, highlighting political, economic, and social rights. Get up and stand up with me, Nkechi Taifa, for Human Rights and Justice.
We declare our rank on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rank of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Yes. We're going to bring it into existence by any means necessary. This is attorney Nkechi Taifa, host of WPFW's Human Rights and Justice. This program is part of Radio Free Palestine, an annual 24-hour marathon airing on Nakba Day, May 15th, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across five continents. I'm so thrilled and honored to have as my guest today none other than a close colleague of mine for just quite a number of years. We're talking about Jamil Dakwar, who is an attorney, a human rights lawyer, an adjunct professor at NYU. He is also the director of the American Civil Liberties Union's Human Rights Program. But he is not speaking in that capacity. He is only speaking in his personal capacity. As we talk today about the Palestinian Solidarity Movement and a right to self-determination for Palestine, in light of the unfolding, unrelenting genocide in Gaza. Welcome, my brother Jamil. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm so thrilled to join you, Nkechi. I'm a big fan of your amazing work and leadership over the years. So thank you for having me on.
It is indeed my pleasure, my brother. So, you know, can you just talk to us a little bit more about yourself? Talk to us about where you grew up, you know, what your experience was as growing up as a Palestinian in Israel. I know you probably shared this many times before. Our WPFW Pacifica audience, share with us about you.
Yeah, well, I think I have a little bit of an unusual background because not only that I'm a Palestinian living now and a citizen of the United States, an American citizen since 2019, actually, but I also I am a citizen of the state of Israel. I was born and raised in Haifa, which is in the north, portal city, beautiful portal city in the north of Israel, which is, you know, in historic Palestine. My upbringing was there. I went to local schools, actually local church-run schools, because the public school system was non-existent for Palestinian citizens. We had, and then we can talk a little more about that in the show. But it was really the only way that Palestinians, particularly who are living inside Israel, could get really good education. They had to go to those church-run schools that are missionary schools that were created like hundreds of years ago. And they were serving the Palestinian community and the Arab community, both Palestinian, Christian, Muslims, and Druze, actually. And teaching and education was the was in Arabic as my first language. My mother tongue language is Arabic. So I went to high school, elementary school, high school in those schools, and then graduated and went to Tel Aviv University Law School, where I pursued my law degree. You know, in Israel, again, there is no Arab university in Israel. There's certainly no law school in Israel. There are only the main Israeli universities are the only place for Palestinians could go, with the exception of few colleges, teacher colleges, but they are not really offering all the different kinds of programs that you want to pursue as a college student. And so I went to Tel Aviv University Law School. I've been involved and active since high school in political and social issues in my high school, but I got more and more involved in what's going on since I went to college or law school in the early 1990s.
Let me just piggyback off what you said when you went to Tel Aviv University. Did you experience any disconnect or anything like that being a Palestinian in an Israeli university? I mean, I went to a predominantly white law school myself, GW. Okay, we'll touch on GW a little later dealing with the student protests. But I'm just curious, as a Palestinian in the early 90s, I think you're saying I'm going to Tel Aviv University. Talk to us a little bit more about.
Yeah, so it was very alienating. You know, Tel Aviv was created years ago, before Israel was even established, as a colony in outside the Palestinian city of Jaffa. So, and it became a much bigger city after Israel was created in 1948. So the area where Tel Aviv University exists right now is actually the area that sits partly on a ruined and destroyed village, Palestinian village that was destroyed in 1948, called Sheikh Mohannes. And that the residents and the Palestinian residents of this village were forced out of that land and they were never allowed to come back. So we've learned about this history. So going there and seeing the high-rise buildings, you know, of Tel Aviv, particularly in that very wealthy area north of Tel Aviv and Ramat Aviv Gimel. Well, first thing that I encountered was actually getting decent housing. It was I couldn't get access to school housing, university housing. I had to go to off campus, and it was really tough to get. And usually the conversation would go like this: "Oh, tell me more about yourself." And then when I mentioned, they would see me, they would think that I'm maybe Jewish Israeli because of my lighter skin. And then when they hear my name and they say, "Oh, what's the origin of your name? And what's your," and then maybe, because as a first year law student, my Hebrew was not great at the time. I had a little accent, obviously, and wasn't ashamed of that. But immediately they realized that they are dealing with an Arab Palestinian. A lot of landlords rejected. And the only way that I was able with other Palestinian students get an apartment was that we had to deposit something like $3,000 on cash, available cash on deposit, which is a lot of money for that period of time. I remember we had to ask family members to give us all their savings and put them on the side. And that was available cash just in case, you know, we do something, ruin the apartment or do something. And that was one of the ways that they have discriminated against applicants who were Palestinian Arabs by, instead of saying, well, many others found different pretexts, but that was my experience. And just in general, the alienation of, like, you are living in a place where most people don't speak your language. And if you spoke your language, you had been looked at as someone who was threatening. And, you know, Arabic is taught very, very in a limited way in Jewish Israeli schools. In fact, it's not a mandatory. There's no mandatory teaching in Arabic in Israeli Jewish schools. But I had to study Hebrew. I studied, of course, English and Arabic. And then because I went to these church schools, I also studied Italian and French until elementary school. So, and I go there and I see, like, we are really a tiny minority. We are a few hundreds, about 600, 700 students in a gigantic university that had, I think, roughly of, at the time, 10,000 or 15,000 students. So we're really a tiny minority. And we had to organize because the student association or council would not accept to integrate a lot of programming for Palestinian students, that we wanted to preserve our culture, our identity as Palestinians, and our activism, political activism, particularly in that time when Israel was switching from was the end of the First Intifada, the beginning of so-called peace process, and there was this joyful atmosphere, environment that finally there is a peace going to happen. But we knew as students, activists, that was not really there was something not right about this process. We of course didn't know all the details, but we did read and we did get news. I remember reading the article that was published by Edward Said, professor at Columbia at the time, who criticized the Oslo Accords as one that betrays the fundamental rights of the Palestinian people. And on the very basic level, that these Oslo Accords in 1993 that were signed between Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, after secret talks that were held, bypassing the talks and held in Oslo, Norway, had only recognized the PLO as legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, not the right to self-determination of the Palestinian people. On the other hand, the PLO had to recognize the Israel right to exist in peace and security, etc. And so there was an imbalance. And we clearly knew that there was something not right. And we also felt that that was marginalizing our call for equality within the state of Israel. As Palestinian citizens, there have been years and decades of systemic racism, structural discrimination against us, land confiscation, housing discrimination, budget allocation inequities in the allocation of budgets, et cetera, et cetera. And we knew that this process was not intended to give us the hope that we will finally be equal citizens. So we had to look inward. And I was part of a movement, student movement. We ended up creating a student movement called Jafra with other colleagues of mine that ended up supporting also a national party calling for equality and for the state of Israel to become a full democracy, state for all its citizens, something that has not been recognized as an important part of the struggle for equality, because Israel claimed that it was a Jewish state and a democratic state. And for us, it was a contradiction. We thought that you can't really be full democracy if you're only going to be a state that we're going to give privileges and you're going to protect the rights of those who are belonging to a particular religion. And so we had that struggle from the very, very early on. So my experience has been really interesting because I also happen to have that background of knowing about the history of Palestine. But most students would not be taught about their history as Palestinians in elementary schools, in high school, particularly because of censorship, because of the control of security services and the Shabak, the Shirut Bitachon Klali, which is the Israel's like a secret service that in charge of internal security was controlling the education system during the time that I was raised in Haifa and later on. So there was a lot of that control that yes, separating the education system in order to control what the Palestinian Arab citizen can teach and can learn, and deny them the ability to be able to be part of the Palestinian people, including in West Bank and Gaza.
So, you know, Jamil, I see a whole lot of similarities between what you talked about in terms of growing up in Palestine and my growing up here in the United States. I grew up in during the 50s and 60s in the United States, and we didn't learn anything about Black history or anything along those lines. It was segregation, there was redlining, all those things that were going on. And even when you were talking about the language situation, it reminded me of Soweto in South Africa, where the Black South Africans were forced to learn in Afrikaans, the language of the white settler colonists, and they wanted their own language. So I see so many similarities. So you talked a little bit about your experience growing up as a Palestinian in Israel. Well, what does it feel like to be a Palestinian right here in America today?
Right. So it is really a very difficult time for the Palestinian people, particularly for Palestinians in Gaza, as they are experiencing, as you said, unrelenting and genocide unfolding as we speak. And we know now today the reports about Israel invading and crushing and bombing Rafah and other parts, even other parts that it said that it had, defeated the resistance there and Hamas from those areas. Now we've seen that this is continuing. So, of course, for Palestinians who live in the United States, we are connected to what's happening by family ties, by knowing this is an ongoing assault on our rights and existence from the very beginning of the creation, not only just the state of Israel, but the creation of really as a Zionist project that really claimed that we did not exist. The whole idea, the whole ideology of the Zionist movement has been that we are, the Zionist movement is going to create to find a land for people without land. In other words, this is will be a movement for finding people without land for land without people, that Palestine was not really inhabited. It was not had this history of people thriving even under the British mandate and control between 1922 and 1947-48. And the Palestinians were part of just like other peoples in the Middle East. They had, some of them were farmers and doing mostly farming and agriculture, but many of them are also were living in major thriving cities like Jaffa, like my home city, Haifa, like Lod and Ramle. Jerusalem was a very thriving city that had both economy and culture and art and you name it, right? And that all stopped, and that all destroyed with the war of 1948, with the Nakba, which we call the catastrophe, the Palestinian catastrophe. The word in Arabic is Nakba, and that is something that Palestinians everywhere feel that continues to this day. In essentially, there's no disconnect between what happened pre-1948 and during the war of 1948 and what is happening to the Palestinians now. So Palestinians in America feeling the heart, the very, very strong feelings of inability to be able to help and support their people and brothers and sisters in the way of being able to be safe and to be protected and to receive the humanitarian support and aid, just like any other nation that is under assault. And unfortunately, being in the United States, it is compounded by the fact that the United States government itself is launching or assisting the Israeli government and complicit in Israeli government attacks on the Gaza Strip and complicit in genocide. Now, there is disagreement about whether that is a genocide or not. I think that people will look back in history and will see that they were wrong. We know that the International Court of Justice, and we can talk more about it, has concluded earlier this year that there is a plausible case that genocide is being unfolding, is taking place. The Biden administration has been sued by the Center for Constitutional Rights for complicity and in failure to prevent acts of genocide. And this case is still pending, and there's an argument in early June before the Ninth Circuit. There is a documentation and analysis by genocide scholars and historians that have said that this is a genocide. We know what United Nations experts have said, that this is a genocide that needs to be prevented, including the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine herself, who did the report just the last month on genocide. And so
I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment. I just must, because I am Nkechi Taifa, and I have studied the International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. And I just, for the life of me, don't understand why there's so much controversy as to what is genocide and what is not. When I looked at the definition, and even in the United States, it was ratified by the United States Senate, and it is the only UN treaty and U.S. law that is actionable without implementing legislation, because it already came with implementing legislation. That definitely, I'm just going to repeat it because I've said it again on this show.
Absolutely.
Killing members bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting upon the group conditions of life calculated to bring about their destruction in whole or in part, taking measures to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children from one group to another. And it said that genocide is not the only actionable act. Conspiracy to commit genocide, directing public incitement to commit genocide, attempt to commit genocide, and complicity. And so I don't understand. It's inviting. Why is there so much controversy and debate over the very obvious thing that is going on right there by the Israelis in Gaza, whether it is or is not a genocide?
Well, I think the reason for that is because it is seen as, if you really looked at the fact and determined that genocide is in fact taking place, there are legal responsibilities first. There are political consequences internationally, what that means, particularly with regard to governments and countries that respect international law, unlike the United States that cherry picks what to take of international law. There are many countries that are actually taking a principled position, and we've seen countries that are cutting ties with the state of Israel because of what's happening in Gaza, like Colombia, like even South Africa took a very strong position of calling back their ambassador. Other countries doing similar acts and saying, look, this is not something that we can agree with. And we have, in fact, obligations as members of or signatories to the genocide conventions to take actions to prevent and to criminalize and to punish those who are inciting to genocide. And that was the purpose of that action that South Africa took. So I think in the United States, it's always been a difficult political sensitivities around the use of the word genocide. It started with genocide against the indigenous peoples in the United States. It goes through the resistance to use of genocide against Black people in the United States. And that's, as you know, and you've spoken and you've written about this, that was the reason why the United States have not ratified the Genocide Convention until 1988. Right. And not only that, it has also resisted the ratification of other international human rights treaties and making them enforceable in a United States domestic courts or having other important domestic implications because of the fact that there was a resistance from early on to Jim Crow and to lynching of Black people and to mass killings that happened over decades and centuries. So, right. So there is always been an exceptions to when and how the genocide will be utilized and used. And I unfortunately, in this case, this is not just about the United States making the decision related to a conflict that's happening overseas that it has no control over. It actually has direct responsibility because of the way that Israel has been using United States weapons, especially offensive weapons, unlike other reporting. And the State Department report that just came out yesterday suggesting that, well, we don't know whether our weapons have been used. But this president himself said on CNN earlier last week that it was, they were used. So they were trying to muddy the water in terms of like, what are the legal obligations? The international law is very clear. As you stated, Genocide Convention defined genocide as the intent to destroy a national or racial, ethnic, or religious group in whole or in part, right? And those acts that constitute genocide could include what we're seeing in Gaza, the killing of members of the group, the Palestinian people, causing serious mental or physical harm to members of the group, imposing conditions that are intended to bring about the physical destruction of the group. If that is not genocide, what is? And so I think that it is really a part of the, unfortunately, the politics of Israel in the United States. And there is a lobby in the United States that is pushing against any attempt to hold Israel accountable. We know that it goes not just with the ICJ and the Genocide Convention. It is related to holding Israel accountable to lesser crimes that have been committed over the decades. War crimes, crimes against humanity, and most recently, in particular, crimes against humanity of apartheid. As Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, Palestinian and Israeli organizations, and even a UN, some UN experts have said that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid in the way that's been treating Palestinians historically. So there is really a double standard and hypocrisy. And in fact, more than that, it is complicity. And that is where I think for us, for Palestinians who live in the United States, back to your question about how do we feel that our government is betraying its own commitments. It's betraying its communities that it said that it is going to embrace them, care for their safety, for their families. But we know that over the years that was not true. Palestinian journalist Shireen Arkley, we had 2 years of since she was killed by snipers in Jenin, covering Israeli military operations in Jenin, and she is a Palestinian-American citizen, and not a single person has been held accountable, even though Secretary Blinken promised, and there was an FBI, some sort of FBI investigation into the killing. So we know that there's always been a gap between what the United States said and what it does when it comes to closest allies, and in this case, Israel is considered as one that is not protecting only its own interests, but it's also in protecting United States interests. And that's a really important point where most people think, oh, that U.S. is doing that for the sake of just supporting Israel. Yes, there is some sort of historical guilt that has that the United States have failed to protect Jewish communities and Jewish people in Europe during World War II and preventing the Holocaust. And that over the years have translated into taking better action, better protection against anti-Semitism, against, but, and then the connection has been made that, well, if you really committed to defending people from anti-Semitism, it shouldn't just be about anti-Semitism in the United States. It had to be supporting Israel as part of the formula that any criticism of Israel, any attack on Israel's legitimacy as a Jewish state, that denies equality to non-Jewish people is anti-Semitic. And this is another part of what we feel in the United States is that even speaking about Palestinian rights in the United States, and me personally been attacked, smeared, and even almost prevented from giving a talk at Indiana University a few years ago because I called for using boycott as a method, as a peaceful method to protest what Israel is doing. And they use that if you're calling for boycott, you would be considered anti-Semitic because you're singling out Israel for this kind of treatment. You are calling Israel that it is a state that has used racist laws, which if even Israeli Jewish scholars and organizations came to the conclusion that there is serious violations of international human rights, particularly the commission of the crime of apartheid since Israel's founding.
You are listening to a 24-hour special on Nakba Day, produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine with the English stream produced by WPFW. Okay, so let me go to another question right now. So while Jewish Israelis will be celebrating Israel's Independence Day this week, Palestinians will be commemorating their Nakba, as you said, great catastrophe of 1948. Can you explain the conflicting narrative? And does this occasion have a special meaning to you and the Palestinian people this year, especially when the genocide is ongoing in Gaza?
Yes, I mean, this is going to be a very difficult week for Palestinian people because, as I said, the Nakba is a trauma, is a traumatic event that is an ongoing one. It has never stopped. It never, even though the majority of the Palestinian people were uprooted, forced to leave, or denied return since the war of 1947-48. And since Israel's existence, it denied the right of Palestinians to return to their homeland. And so the majority of the Palestinian people became refugees in neighboring Arab countries. To this day, you have refugee camps all over Lebanon and Jordan and Syria, and few have also became refugees in Egypt. And so the Nakba, that event that created Israel, which Jewish Israelis celebrate as their Independence Day. It is for us the day that has caused the destruction of our homeland, the destruction of over 400 Palestinian towns and villages, including major communities, thriving communities in cities like Jaffa, Lod, Ramle, and Haifa. It resembles the mass displacement and killing, but also the depriving Palestinians of ability to not only live in their homeland, but also to connect and to preserve their culture, to preserve their history, to preserve their ability to bring their existence and to share it with their new generation. So the Nakba is an ongoing and traumatic event for us. And what's happening in Gaza, in fact, since the very beginning of the war, we have warned that what we're seeing is a continuation of the Nakba, because the Palestinians who are living in Gaza are actually 75% or more are descendants of refugees who became refugees in 1948, and some of them also became refugees or internally displaced people during the 1967 war, when Israel expanded its control over Palestinians from 80% of historic Palestine to 100% of historic Palestine by occupying the West Bank and Gaza. So the people who live in Gaza have already gone through the Nakba. They have already been displaced. They can see and they are 5 or 7 miles away from their original hometowns and villages, which were completely destroyed. And over those towns and villages, Israel created settlements that were intended to set facts on the ground that there is no return. This is not a homeland for the Palestinian people. You stay out of Palestine. This is new entity that is called Israel. And that is actually, by the way, it's also a violation of UN partition plan from 1947. That plan, which rejected by the Palestinian leadership and generally Palestinian people, because they thought was unfair. It was taking major parts of their homeland, dividing it and giving it to a movement or members of the community that were coming and establishing settlements and considered themselves as colonizers. I mean, it's not that the Palestinians are defining the Zionist movement as a settler colonial movement. It was defined by the founders, by organizations that were created and called and used the word settler organizations or movement, mm-hmm. etc. So, but the one thing that obviously makes it very different than many other settler colonial situations is that many of the people who had come to Israel since 1948, since its creation, some of them been able to come before 48, before the war, were the victims of the Holocaust. They were the ones who were in themselves persecuted and subject to mass slaughter and genocide in Europe. It has nothing to do with Palestinians or Arab nations. It was a German Nazi plan to exterminate Jewish people and cause this horror. and led to the fact that many of the Jewish people felt no place to go. In fact, there were many countries that would not take Jewish refugees. The only place that could go was the state of Israel, including the United States, that had some of your viewers, you would remember the case of the St. Louis, which is the ship that was carrying Jewish refugees and came to rejected from reaching the shores of the United States.
Yeah.
And was rejected. And many of those people have been survivors of and have been returned to Europe where they had been massacred. So there is a very difficult a narrative here that it's not easy to understand if you're just going to go along with just, you know, super, you know, very, very much on the surface or without digging deep into what's happened. So for many Jewish Israelis, Israel has been created as the place for the gathering of Jewish refugees, safe haven for Jewish people who were persecuted and slaughtered in Europe. But they ultimately, what ends up happening, those victims of the genocide on Europe, the major genocide on Europe of World War II, has now become involved in mass atrocities against the people who were living in Palestine. And so we are the Palestinians, as Edward Said said once, we are the victims of the victims. And that is very difficult time because for many Israelis, and I listen to Jewish Israeli press or Hebrew press, and there, it is also a traumatic event for them, October 7th, because there were civilians who were targeted and attacked that were not combatants, and there were serious violations of human rights and international humanitarian law, and that has to be recognized and had to be investigated fully, and including, by the way, any allegations of sexual crimes that committed during that day, which need to be taken seriously. But that's why I think we need to look forward into, okay, how do you get out of the situation? And the memory of the Nakba and what we will be commemorating this week has to be coupled with the commitment to ending the genocide first, mm-hmm. ending the denial of the Nakba of 1948, because many people in Israel say, including the official Israeli government position, there is no such a Nakba. There is no such thing. It was your fault. You left the country. It's your leadership who called on you to leave the country. All kind of propaganda that really doesn't hold water is not supported by historical facts. And more importantly, there's a need to have the ability to search for truth mm-hmm. and reconciliation, but with accountability. Here's where I wanted to say a couple of words about the International Criminal Court, because the International Criminal Court, which was set up since 2002, under the 1998 Rome Statute or Agreement, was intended to end impunity for the worst crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. Later on, it was added the crime of aggression. And that court had been a revolutionary in the sense of turning point in the history of humankind, that for the first time since the Nuremberg trials, which were one-sided in the sense that they were only directed against the Nazi criminals, but did not really address other crimes. For example, a crime of dropping atomic bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima that has never been investigated as a crime against humanity. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that International Criminal Court was set up in order to exactly deter and investigate the worst crimes, including genocide. And Palestine got a very important status at the United Nations, which was observer non-member state status, allowed it to join international organizations, including signing and ratifying treaties, which it did. And it is now part of the ICC. And Israel, by committing crimes in territories that are defined under the Palestine as a state, even though there is no real the same kind of institutions that and ability for state to take on, but at least at the level of UN recognition and international recognition, it had opened a number of investigations before October 7, before the genocide was unfolding. But right now, the eyes are on the ICC and the criminal prosecutor, general prosecutor of the ICC, whether he would really take the right step of issuing arrest warrants against Israeli officials, Israeli leaders, and military commanders who were involved in instituting and committing the crimes and atrocities that we've seen. We don't know what the scope of that, what the basis of the arrest warrant, but there were some reports that this is very imminent. And mm-hmm. Israel's position was, if that happens, we are going to punish the Palestinian Authority that has led the demand for accountability at the ICC. In fact, there's a chorus of politicians in the United States that are calling to punish Palestinians and the Palestinian Authority that is for such actions. Biden administration is opposing any action by the ICC because that is what the United States has been doing to protect Israel from such accountability actions. That would be a test. That would be an important test because it's added to the ICJ move in pushing for...
This is Radio Free Palestine. Back in a moment.
Good evening. I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the headlines. Hundreds of people are gathering at this hour to support students who have occupied the CUNY Grad Center and renamed it Al-Aqsa University Library after a library destroyed in Gaza. Palestinian flags and signs supporting Gaza hung inside the Mina Reis Library on Manhattan's Fifth Avenue as the protesters chanted and read aloud the names of 94 professors killed in Gaza. Meanwhile, CUNY Graduate Center President Joshua Broomberg met with the student protesters in the lobby and tried to negotiate a deal. In northern Florida on Tuesday, a bus crash killed 8 migrant workers and injured at least 40 others, many critically, in rural Marion County. Florida Highway Patrol spokesperson.
The school bus traveled off the roadway onto the grass shoulder where it went through a fence, struck a tree, and overturned.
Marion County Sheriff Billy Woods said the workers were migrants who were hired to do agricultural work in Florida. Woods said he believed that they were in the country legally.
There's no reason for me to be involved with these individuals. They're hardworking individuals, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with them being here.
The workers were being transported in an old school bus to Cannon Farms to harvest peanuts and watermelons for grocery stores in the U.S. and Canada. The company had recently advertised for a temporary driver to bus workers to watermelon fields. The pay was $14.77 an hour. And part of a collapsed bridge in Baltimore has been deliberately destroyed, clearing the way for the eventual full return of shipping through one of the busiest sea routes in the U.S. Authorities said the demolition went according to plan. A ship struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge on March 26th, causing it to collapse and killing 6 construction workers. Maryland Governor Wes Moore read the names of the victims.
To the loved ones of Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes, Jose Lopez, Dorleon Castillo Cabrera, Menor Yasir Suazo Sandoval, Carlos Daniel Hernandez Estrella, and Miguel Angel Luna Gonzalez.
Moore went on to say he's working with Congress and other politicians to get the bridge rebuilt.
So we are moving fast. We're covering all bases. We're not slowing down. And we're going to get it done together.
The city of Baltimore sued the ship's owners, alleging gross negligence and recklessness. In international news, during a meeting with Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba in Kyiv, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the Biden administration is working to deliver a new round of aid authorized in late April.
We will provide an additional $2 billion in foreign military financing for Ukraine. We put this together in a first-of-its-kind defense enterprise fund to provide weapons today, investing in Ukraine's defense industrial base, but also using this fund to help Ukraine purchase military equipment from other countries.
Meanwhile, Russia says its forces seized 2 more settlements in the Kharkiv region, where Russian forces have been intensifying an offensive. On Tuesday, President Joe Biden